Hi, Carolina, it's Gideon. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Gideon.
Hi.
How are you?
I wanted to ask something about the bit at the very end. Why isn't there a process that privileges flipper over reconnector in that case? Suppose that the flipper switches things from left to right. And there could have been a little thing on the left-hand track that would have left a trace in the effect. You know, a red can of paint. And there could have been a blue can of paint on the right-hand track. Because flipper switched the thing, the car is destroyed and a blue can of paint flies everywhere. In that case, there's a trace of flipper's activity in the effect, but no trace of reconnector's activity in the effect. And the fact that there happened to be no paint in the scene shouldn't make a difference.
Good, yes. Thank you so much. That is why I said somewhere in the handout, processes of the right kind. So this is not supposed to be an account of causation, right? I'm not interested in giving a reductive account of causation. Any process-based account of causation is going to face this problem, that there are going to be pseudo-processes that are not causal. I don't think you actually need to appeal to the can of paint example to see that there is some kind of process involving flipper, right? Because the train was going on down the tracks, and then flipper flips the switch. So the process would involve the train going onto that other track and then keeps going on that track until it reaches the reconvergence point and so on. So there's some kind of continuous physical process where you can argue flipper is involved. There isn't any such thing for reconnector. But of course, the problem is we don't want to say that's a process of the right kind, just like in the can of paint example. That's not enough for flipper to be a cause. So the problem would be to explain the difference between processes that matter for causation and processes that don't matter. And I don't have a recipe to offer in that regard. I was just trying to make sense of how one could supplement Steve's account with process-related resources in order to be able to extend the account in a way that would allow us to hold agents responsible in this case while avoiding other problems that would arise for the account as a result, such as why shouldn't we hold both agents responsible in other cases too? Or why isn't it the case that either Susie or Billy, the disjunctive fact, is the cause in the other normal case, where I think it's not? So that was the main question that I was trying to address, but I don't have anything substantial to offer in that regard. Thank you. Sorry, I have this light shining on my face and I can't get rid of it. It's the middle of the morning here, so.
Hi, Carolina. How are things? I just wanted to say that the theory that you're so ably criticizing was like largely or significantly based on comments that you made along the way in those early 2000s years about how oftentimes what makes something a cause isn't that it was necessary, but that it was sort of making it easier for the effect to occur, that it was sort of easing the effects, sort of cutting into the effects, sort of debt load. And that was really like, all I was trying to do is capture your...
I can't hear anything. I think you're muted.
Yeah? Can you hear now?
Yes, perfect.
Hi. Oh, okay.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. Well, I was just saying at great length that you're great, and that the account that you're criticizing, I interpret it more as I'm like the switcher that switched your criticism back onto you, because the account was so much inspired by things that you'd said along the way about how causes aren't necessarily things, or effects aren't necessarily, don't necessarily hinge on their causes, but effects sort of have a certain debt load, a bunch of things that have to go right for the effect to occur, and anything that cuts in the right way into the debt load, even if something else would have cut into it, is enough to make it a cause. Anyway, so thank you for that. So this is maybe a tiny bit related to Gideon's. I really don't have any response at all. It's a really great bunch of examples and questions. But so I take it that if suppose Switcher had switched the train onto this other track, and after that, someone had, Disconnector had disconnected the original track, and then Reconnector had reconnected it. All that happened fairly quickly, so there never really was ultimately any real need for the switch, because there was an intact track on the other side. I suppose we should add that Disconnector and Reconnector didn't know where the train was or something of that nature, so it wasn't playing that indirect causal role. And so so in that kind of case, I think we could still, or could we, I don't know what your intuition is there. I mean, part of me wants to say, well, maybe Switcher did relieve the effect of what would otherwise have been the need for a Reconnector to reconnect the track. But of course, to your point, in your example, it all happens beforehand.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's already.
That's why.
Yeah, I figured. Yeah. So you're saying you crafted your example so that it wouldn't be vulnerable to simple-minded counterexample. That's an MIT trait. I'm glad I still have that.
Let me say. So in the paper where I developed these ideas and argued for disjunctive causes, it was all happening at once.
Oh.
So that's like in the intermediate case where I'm not sure what you would say in that intermediate case. I was sure that you would have wanted to say if Reconnector had reconnected the track later on, then Flipper or Switcher is a much better name, actually. Switcher is really relieving the effect of some needs. And I think that sounds right to me. Yeah. So I might want to agree about that. I'm not sure if it all happens at the same time. But definitely, given that it happened before, it seems to me that the reconnection has already happened, so the cases are completely alike from that point on.
Well, I was wondering if it was, so what do you think about this kind of case? There's bombers overhead. We've talked about this kind of case too. And they're threatening to bomb the original track, but they don't actually succeed in doing that. So the original track is intact, but nevertheless, since they weren't threatening to bomb the new track that the train was switched onto, you might the switching sort of relieved.
What would you want to say?
Well, I'd want to say that it was a cause in that case, and then I'm feeling because it relieved it of maybe not sort of a definite need, but a risk. Well, or the need for maybe there was a definite need for the planes not to have, their bombs not to have hit the original track. And then now, here's where I'm really, really reaching, and so this is where I'm really conceding, I have no answer. The fact that someone earlier was able to disattach the original track, to me that casts a pall over the whole, original track scenario, and it's sort of like, leads to, there's some greater security that's achieved. I'm not sure whether it's to be stated in terms of probability or safety of some other kind, but you've got a track that's already shown itself to be insufficiently guarded by the.
I think what I would want to say about the bombing, the bomber's case, is probably that if it was a truly, genuinely indeterministic process, so that there was really an objective risk, even if it's a risk that never eventuated, that's the kind of case where I might want to be able to conceive. It's eliminating that need. So the switching is the cause. Other kinds of risks, I'm not so sure that, you know, don't really pose any objective risk. There's no objective probability associated with them. But more fundamentally, so what my account of the connection between causation and responsibility says is that we should be able to hold one agent morally responsible for the outcome to the extent that we can hold them morally responsible for that disjunctive cause. And then there's a further question that arises there that is a really, really difficult question of when can we hold agents morally responsible for disjunctive facts that they guarantee because their individual contributions are sufficient for the disjunctive fact obtaining. But I don't think that's necessarily a reason to think that they're always responsible for their disjunctive facts. So it's only in some cases that they are, in other cases they're not. And so we can play with all of these examples that you have been coming up with and thinking about whether we might want to say that either switcher or reconnector were responsible for that disjunctive cause. And whether they are responsible for the outcome would really depend on that. The cause is always the same. It's the disjunctive cause. So then the responsibility of the agents just hinges on whether they're responsible for the disjunctive cause. So that's what I would want to say, putting it all together, right? Ultimately, that would be my suggestion. But we have to be able to allow for some disjunctive causes into our account.
Okay. Excellent. Thanks.
Thank you.
And no questions from the Zoom?
So tell us why it isn't a case of overdetermination.
You mean a case of overdetermination in the sense of symmetric overdetermination, where each one of them is a cause?
Well,
I don't think each one of them is a cause because there are independent reasons for believing that neither of them is a cause individually. So if they were individual causes and the effect is just overdetermined, then they would also be individual causes in the other examples. So switcher would be an individual cause in the original case, and he's not. It is an overdetermination case in a broader sense. In the sense that, I mean, some people even believe that overdeterminers are not individual causes. So that's fine with me, right? So you might even believe that all overdetermination cases should be resolved in this way. The cause is always disjunctive. So it can be an overdetermination case in that sense, in the sense that there's counterfactual dependence between the disjunctive fact and the outcome. And that makes the disjunctive fact a cause, but there's no individual causation between any of the disjuncts and the outcome. But yeah, the main reason for thinking they're not overdeterminers in the other more loaded sense is that that would make them individual causes, and I think that's wrong. It's wrong to say that they are.
But the argument that what Switcher did wasn't an individual cause, based on what you said. In the original case, Switcher wasn't. seems to already import something process-like into the theory, because it's sort of, it sounds like you're saying it's sort of an intrinsic affair between switcher and where the train went and the effect. Why couldn't it make switcher an individual cause that this other weird stuff had happened earlier?
I'm sorry, I'm sure I'm following. So in the original case, switcher is not an individual cause in the sense that matters for moral responsibility, because all the other conditions for responsibility are met, and we still don't want to hold switcher morally responsible for the outcome.
Right.
So but the, it's got to be, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, right. So if you had a premise that said things were intrinsically the same between switcher and the outcome, between the original case and where there is no tampering with the track, maybe I'm misremembering what the original case was, but I was thinking the original case, there is no tampering with the track.
Yes, okay. That's right, yes.
So in the second case, there was some tampering with the track, so that makes for an extrinsic difference.
Mm.
Unless you think that causation is intrinsic, that could...
No, that's not the justification. It's just that the tampering with the tracks was fixed some time ago. So
okay.
I think intuitively that difference doesn't matter. It's an extrinsic difference that shouldn't matter to the causal structure of the case. And when you think about moral responsibility, I think it's the same. So the track has already been reconnected. Switcher is not morally responsible, I think, in that case. So this is another work of mine where I talk about similar cases where I think the person we should hold responsible is the agent that guaranteed the obtaining of the destructive cause earlier on. So that would be reconnector. In the example that I didn't get to talk about in the handout, there was another case like that where Lazy doesn't jump in to save the child, and the sharks are in the water. But the reason they're in the water is that they were released by some other agent earlier on in the day, or the day before, or weeks ago, right? So I think in that case, it's clear that we should hold that agent morally responsible. Although clearly he's not an individual cause, but we can still hook him up to the outcome through that destructive fact that is the cause of the outcome. And then Lazy would not be morally responsible because he's not morally responsible for the destructive cause. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Too much sense.
Cool.
Gideon has another question.
Cool, thank you. Thank you again.
So I think these cases are close to one of the, you know, a standard law school hypothetical. You know, guy goes out into the desert, is going out into the desert, person A wants to kill him and puts poison in the canteen, person B, acting totally independently, wants to kill him and puts a little hole in the canteen so the water dribbles out. Guy gets out into the middle of the desert, sees that he's got no water, lingers on for 2 weeks and dies of thirst, of dehydration.
Yes.
The poisoner acted first. But
yes.
It's very hard to see him as responsible for the death because the guy never got anywhere near the poison.
Yes, but that's what I say. Well, actually, I say that about another case where there is no poison, but the person had drained the water out and replaced it with salt or rocks or something like that, because adding the poison complicates matters a little bit, because then you're starting to imagine he had drunk the poison, then he would have been death by poisoning, but not death by, yeah. So, yes, yeah, so I have another paper where I talk about that example, and I apply this framework, and that is my conclusion. But, I mean, the main conclusion that I want to draw from considering that case or other examples like that is that we should be able to hold somebody responsible because two wrongs don't make a right. And we can do that because there's disjunctive causation, or to the extent that there's disjunctive causation, we can say that. And then the further, more difficult question would be, who should we hold responsible for the death? Is it the person who acted first, or is it the person who acted second? Now, it's true, I mean, in all of these cases, with regard to the first agent, there is no process linking that agent to the outcome. But there is no process in cases of omission either, and we still hold them responsible. So I think that that by itself is not necessarily a problem. But I do think it's a really difficult question. And it's interesting, right, that the law would have to decide cases like this where we can't even agree on who's responsible in the first place. But I think we should agree that somebody is, and not believe, like Michael Moore does, for example, that nobody is responsible in these cases because they cancel each other out. And two wrongs can't make a right. I think that's even worse than having to face this additional question. Right?
One thing to be said in favor of holding the second actor responsible in some of these cases, well, two things. First of all, things go exactly as he plans. So he envisages a process leading to the death, and that's the process that's realized. And second of all, anything that the first agent does is prevented from going to completion by an intervening human act. And as the law tends to think of things, intervening human acts break causal chains.
Yes. Yeah, but I'm not sure that the law is right about that in the first place. Actually, the example that I talked about in that paper of mine was still a little bit different. So the first person punches the hole, not the second person. Yeah. And then the second person steals the canteen from the man. Would that change anything? Because that's the kind of case where I would want to say, It's the first person that's responsible, not the second one. But it's still true, I guess, that it's going according to the plan that the second agent had more than according to the plan that the first agent had. So it's true. I mean, if that kind of foreseeability condition matters, then that would be a reason for wanting to hold the second agent. So I think the question is, who is responsible for that disjunctive fact? But it's such a weird question that we don't know how to answer it.
Totally weird.
So yeah, I really welcome any suggestions like the ones you have. Thank you.
No more suggestions.
We are also exactly, it just remains 1 minute. So if no one else has a comment, we can just thank you very much, Carolina, for having joined us tonight.
Thank you.